If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, should we stop building studios? In the wake of the latest AI developments, that's what one investor is doing. Also on the programme, New Zealand's Challenger Channel dumps news and takes the country back to 1989. And Vice closes its website. Can it survive on social media alone? All that plus there's changes at Radio 3, why VR may not be the future after all. And in the media quiz, we discover the talent driving change at some established brands. That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, the BBC has released its report into the Hugh Edwards scandal, concluding that it had not acted quickly enough when the first complaint came in. The corporation has apologised to the boy's parents. GB News has spent over £600,000 on Conservative MPs over the past year, according to The Guardian. The paper revealed that just £1,100 was spent on Labour MPs in the same period. Could this be the left-wing equivalent of the BBC's highest earner list? Time will tell. And a word of advice for any live presenters listening, when thinking up features to hook onto the launch of Channel 4's The Jury, don't ask members of the public to phone in with their own jury stories. This is a big no-no. Now, joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we welcome back two media pundits that know their media lore from their elbow. First up, it's Professor Liz Howells, Professor Emeritus at City University, and former VP of TV channels, including Living and Bravo.
Correct.
Hello, nice to see you.
Quite a range there.
So you've had sort of time at channels. Yeah. And I just noticed before we recorded this that Channel 4 are going to move Hollyoaks to 3 episodes a week over on E4. Soaps are quite important, aren't they, for channels?
Well, they've got to have their soaps, I suppose, traditionally, and there's a very wide following. But then the audience moves around and you've got to follow them too. So what it's saying, I think, is there isn't quite the demand that there was, and it's also on E4 anyway. So I wouldn't say it's the death knell for the soap as such, but I think the big days of the soaps are gone.
Yes. And it used to have huge ratings for all soap operas on all channels, which made them a very efficient programme to have on the network.
Well, there were failed soaps as well. There was one called Albion Market, which I think Granada tried to take on, and that didn't work. They've got to somehow hit the zeitgeist, you know, to really work. And of course, the set in Crossroads didn't work either. So you can't just say they're automatic bankers, and that's changing anyway now. In fact, the whole thing is changing about what people want, and probably the soap reflecting everyday life is not what people want. They want something much more than everyday life.
So my chance of an El Dorado reboot, I'm likely to happen.
I'd forgotten about El Dorado. That was a good try as well.
And we also welcome back from media research specialists Kantar. It's Jane Osler. Hello.
Hello, Matt.
I saw one of our old colleagues is moving on.
Yeah, so it was announced this week that Stephen Myron is stepping down as CEO and will move to chairman of Global. Interesting scenario, because obviously he's been there for, I think, about 15 years.
Pretty much from the beginning.
Obviously, they made lots of acquisitions in that time, broadened out into entertainment and events, and also made an acquisition of, you know, out of home as well. So it's not just radio. It's a lot more than that. So, yeah, it's probably going to be a pretty tough act to follow. To recruit the new CEO is going to be interesting.
They've announced it nice and early, a nice sort of year-long leaving party for him.
Yes. So it's not a surprise, I guess, when it actually happens. And, you know, it's quite an orderly way to make a transition, I think. So it's a sensible approach, I
it would is,
say.
It yeah. is. And you're going to be doing some podcasting of yourself, probably from this studio tomorrow. What's on your agenda?
Well, obviously, I love this studio. I love coming here. And in fact, I was thinking maybe I should have just stayed the night or something because it would be easier. I'm interviewing some people for our Kantar Future Proof podcast tomorrow. The topic tomorrow is creativity, high quality advertising. And I'm going to be speaking to the CEO of a travel company in Denmark and the ad agency and my colleague Vera, who evaluated the campaign for Effie's Europe. It was an award-winning campaign called Dogcation.
Right.
And so the travel company identified that some people don't go on holiday because they're too worried about leaving their dogs behind, and so set up alternative holidays for dogs to, you know, encourage people to take their human holidays. A very entertaining campaign using humour, which we know is one of the most successful drivers of effective advertising and is not used enough. So, yeah.
Well, follow the Future Proof podcast and then you'll get it when it is out. Now, in a shape of things to come, media investor Tyler Perry has halted all new spending until he can assess the future impact of Sora. This is the new AI video generation tool from OpenAI. Liz, Perry is a big investor in US studios and sound stages, and there's plenty of those being built here in the UK too. Is he right to be worried?
I couldn't quite get his drift on this. Mm. When he says he's worried, is he worried on a moral, ethical ground because so many people will lose their jobs to AI, or because AI isn't trustworthy? Or is he worried because he thinks I'm going to plunge my money into normal sound stages and then find that I could have done it for, you know, a tenth of the price or something? So I'm not quite sure where he's coming from on this. Is he trying to have the cake and the halfpenny by saying, oh, I'm so worried about AI, but I'm not going to invest in anything till I know if I can save money with it? So
I mean, Jane, it is an interesting challenge for producers. I mean, I'm sure like me, you looked at the Sora.
Yeah.
And the ones they showed looked pretty good. Woman's slightly strange arm, but like generally,
yes.
Generally pretty good stuff. You could see why someone would think, oh, how I do television or film may have to change.
Yeah, it looks on the face of it like generative AI for video, you know, with all these new advancements could actually, you know, replace normal production techniques. My question, though, would be, will they be differentiated enough? Will they all slightly look a bit the same? Mm-hmm. Are they generic in their output, even if you're being super smart with the prompts? I mean, it's the same issue is happening in advertising and creative agencies as well. And, you know, I saw all those clips, you know, watched them all endlessly. And yes, they do look superficially impressive. But
they,
you know,
are the ones they chose to put on their website.
Of course, you know.
I don't know that one of the couple walking through Tokyo in the snow and the blossom. I thought that was really weird. It was sort of bouncing along a bit, weren't they?
Yeah. And so, you know, you have to expect that those abilities, those technological leaps will happen to make things look a bit more normal. But do we have an emotional connection with them, or do they just look slightly odd?
I sort of thought some of it, like, we use video in lots of different ways in all media. And I was thinking about giving presentations, and sometimes you have like kind of slightly faded video playing in the background of something while your slides are on. And actually for that, this is pretty amazing. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. I mean, it's not going to, Channel 4 aren't going to be able to make a Hollyoaks episode using this, are they?
Well, not at the moment, I shouldn't say. Not at all, no. I mean, there is something slightly artificial about it, or at least about the clips we saw. They were a little bit too clean, a bit too gorgeous, you know, which is, can happen with ordinary filmmaking as well, when they sort of have a completely clean street somewhere and you think, no, it's not really like that. But I was thinking that there's always been these sort of advances where people feel that reality is encroached upon. And in fact, we live in a very artificial world anyway. Our world of video and television is very artificial. And I'm thinking of way back when a friend of mine worked on those big dramas at Granada, you know, Jewel in the Crown and Brideshead We Visited, and spent hours and hours at Pinewood or somewhere doing a back projection of the Taj Mahal or whatever it was supposed to be. And it was just as artificial. It just took an awful lot longer.
Yes.
So our world is an artificial world. That's what we largely, unless we're in hard news, that's what we portray. It's the entertainment of artificiality. People don't want the ordinary all the time.
I mean, Jane, will the producers that do well from this be able to, and same for ad creators, be able to mix together what we know works and how to use this technology in a new way?
Well, this is what you expect. I think the general answer with any question to do with AI or generative AI is it does require an optimum balance between the technology and human input. So you have to expect that at some point humans will be involved. There will still be, you know, stars, there will still be actors, there will still be voices. Whether they're artificially generated is a different question. And there will still be storytelling that needs to happen, that happens behind the scenes. So what Tyler Perry has done is probably a fairly extreme reaction. Actually, you know, it usually sorts itself out in balance. You might find that for some genres it's more applicable, maybe kids' movies or something like that. I don't know. But I think there's, you know, there is the uncanny valley issue going on at the moment, even with Sora.
Yeah, I'd probably be worried if I was in like the stock video business.
Yeah.
It's those sorts of things, isn't it? Where you think, well, actually, suddenly at the lower end, this can kind of snaffle some of that stuff
up. But I think we are right to be concerned about AI, but very much more in the area of information and bots and chatbots and so on. I do find that quite alarming that you do not know who you're talking to. Even when you book a restaurant, you get someone to say, "Hi, I'm Emma." And you think, I thought this was an Indian restaurant, you know. But it can be very disconcerting and very artificial. And I work a lot with primary school children doing news clubs for them, and they really do fall hook, line and sinker for all of this artificiality, and they're forever trying to get out the iPads that are locked in the school cupboard. Any excuse to get the iPad out and look at themselves with a moustache on or something. It is a little bit
concerning. And it's not just the kids that fall for a lot of that stuff either. Well, speaking of news, New Zealand's commercial TV channel 3, which is sort of like ITV compared to the BBC here, is to stop its news service, according to the broadcaster's owners, Warner Brothers Discovery. It leaves the country with mainly sort of one TV news provider, the state-funded TVNZ. And they, not only news, they're going to cut back a lot of their own sort of production and kind of become a sort of what we term a kind of digital channel in like lots of repeats, lots of imported material. I mean, I sort of looked at this, Liz, and thought, is this a harbinger of things to come, or is it what happens in a smaller market, 5 million people in New Zealand, where there's less cash knocking around?
I think it's much the latter. And in fact, it isn't a comparative with ITV, because ITV is a public service broadcast, which is under the Broadcasting Act and has to do certain things under the Ofcom
at the moment.
Rules. At the moment, yeah. But there's no reason to think that that is going to change. And they have to fulfil certain obligations because they have this universal provision through the transmission system. And so that's the quid pro quo.
But the benefit of that quid pro quo,
It will go down, yes, but not immediately.
But I was sort of thinking, like, if you took Channel 5, which, again, public broadcaster, has some of those commitments as well.
Absolutely.
Owned by an American company. Yeah. I don't think it's a million miles away that they could look at this and go, well, at some point, does 5 have to...
At the moment, it is a million miles away. Because just at the moment, they are governed by the Broadcasting Act and they do have to fulfil these obligations. And they still get an enormous advantage from being, as it were, one of the six kids on the block as regards provision.
On the EPG, high at the EPG,
Absolutely. Mm. So they have got to do these things. And I think also there is no will in this country to stop them doing these things. And there's no will probably in the channels themselves to stop them doing these things.
Jane?
Well, in the items that I read about this story, they cited the reason for this happening was because of falling ad revenues.
Yes.
So obviously it does all come down to money.
Yep.
And you have to follow the money.
Absolutely.
And I thought, you know, it was interesting in our last piece of media reactions research, we interviewed a whole host of marketers, nearly 1,000 marketers around the world. And of the channels that they wanted to advertise in, TV is no longer in the top five.
Right.
So it does kind of speak more broadly, I think, to a trend of, you know, TV does need to do more to innovate, to make its advertising formats more relevant and seem fresher for consumers as well as marketers. So ultimately, you know, for me, it's a cost-cutting exercise.
I mean, it's a £1.5 billion. I tried to work out the numbers. So I think it's about £1.5 billion ad market in New Zealand, which isn't super huge, and I suppose it's at the edges, isn't it, when everything starts to crunch. So if you're small already and then there's a change in advertiser behavior, you can be left holding the baby.
And it's not a question of just cutting a few people. You have to sort of cut the actual services as well.
Yes, you do. The thing about news is that it's very expensive. And there is a saying that is attributed to Rupert Murdoch, though I have no reason to think he actually said it, but it's quite a good one. And his saying was, with entertainment, you make money, but with news, you dine at the White House. Mm. And people go into news for different reasons. If you look at GB News, for example, they've got two major shareholders who are prepared to stand the increasing costs and the expense of running that channel because they like having it.
Yes, absolutely.
News is a different thing. So you can still have commercial news depending on the model. And if the model is the sugar daddy model, you're going to be okay. But in this particular instance, they haven't got a sugar daddy. They're dependent on advertising, and that is limited.
So the channel is owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, and they obviously run news operations all around the world. They said that, you know, it's up to New Zealand to work out its own budget. It's not for head office to pay the bills. I mean, Discovery themselves are going through their own issues, and it helps them to have a sort of easier cash flow.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think that the other thing that I thought was interesting about the story as well is that if you think about it, news and itself and advertising around news can be fairly divisive. Mm. I mean, it came to the fore with COVID-19, really, when advertisers started being really sensitive about where their ads were appearing. It's not just an online digital phenomenon. It also applies to broadcast channels as well. And I think it might be a sort of reticence on the part of advertisers. And again, that may not be just confined to New Zealand.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Advertisers are much more careful and sensitive about certain things now. Mm. And in the days when they just bought the massive eyeballs, those days have gone. So we've got a different relationship with advertisers happening, haven't we?
And more changes, this time at Radio 3. We don't often see kind of Radio 3 changes. It's one of those stations that sometimes could be argued is preserved in aspic, mainly because its listeners can be quite grumpy. I think that's probably the polite version. They're not necessarily up for lots of changes. And some of those old listeners are in Parliament too, which never helps the controller. There's a relatively new controller. Sam Jackson joined around this time last year, and this is his first go of changes. Liz, a lot of the speech strands are going, some over to Radio 4. This is part of them working out what they are as a brand today?
Yeah, I think that's really sensible because most people associate Radio 3 with classical music. And it's a bit of a shock when you get a verbal strand. You know,
yes.
You think, well, what's this about? I'm not saying they're not good, but they don't seem to me to fit. Mm. I do quite like Radio 3. One of the things I like about it is that I really enjoy choral singing. Mm. I'm in two choirs and do lots of concerts and stuff like that. I know it seems a bit weird, but it's a big part of my life. And lots of my friends of all ages, I have to say, are in choirs. And Radio 3 does showcase British choral music. In a big way, and it's very, very important. And I think they're sticking with
yes,
that.
Choral survives.
Look at the BBC singers and so on. And so I don't think this is a really big change. I'm quite entertained by the people that they've brought in, and that fits with the criticism of BBC Sounds that it's all celebs. But that gets us into a fascinating but lengthy discussion about what celebrity is.
Also, that they've added Jules Holland, haven't they?
Yes.
To the station.
Oh, but Jane, he is a very good musician.
He is, and I think it speaks to a kind of, perhaps, and they mention this, a kind of lighter touch all round. Mm. So there's an interesting crossover now, I think, and it reflects itself in the proms as well, with sort of orchestral music that's combined with something else. You know, you think of, you know, Pete Tong, or something like that. And I think it looks like a deliberately more populist play. And it's presumably because, you know, they can't stand still with the audience as it is, who are at the older end of the BBC listening spectrum. So, you know, it makes sense to have presenters with broader appeal who are less specialist. I thought Clive Myrie was an interesting one. There was a mention of him as well. And I think it's, you know, a lighter touch is important. Obviously, it's competing as well with Classic FM.
That's where I think they've got to be careful.
They've got to be very careful. Yeah. And I mean, Radio 3 has always had about 2 million listeners. Yeah. Like literally for the last 20 years. And it goes up and down. It's dropped a little bit recently. It's always been around the same amount. Obviously, Sam was previously at Classic FM, so he understands what Classic FM does. But it's difficult because you instantly get accused of dumbing down whatever you do, don't you?
Absolutely. And there's some really, really good stuff that isn't dumb at all, like Composer of the Week, if I can give it a plug. I really enjoy that. So, you know, there's a lot of good stuff on Radio 3. I'm a bit concerned about this you know, the listener thing, because it says in these stats I saw total listeners per week 1.9 million. Mm-hmm. But is that reach or is that individual listeners? And I always find this very irritating.
So that's reach. Of course, it reaches 1.9 million over a week.
So how many people actually listen? This is people listening two or three times in a week. Mm. I think we've got to be careful because Radio 3 is a great thing. I really like it and all the rest of it. But there's a tendency to think of it as a sort of sacred cow in the way that local radio, which actually probably gets five times as many listeners, is not treated. And I do think that's an unfairness.
I mean, there is always that thing with the BBC, isn't there? But any changes get a big response.
Yeah.
They, one hand, licence fee payers have got to get something. Mm. But the other hand, you've got to do something distinctive. They're always stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah. This isn't a major change, is it? It doesn't worry me about, you know, when I'm doing the ironing. Actually, it's not me that does the ironing.
But that's
about Radio 3.
But that's it, I guess, for Sam. He has sort of... When I was looking at it, I was thinking this is a little bit about brands.
Yeah.
So breakfast as a brand, mornings being a bit solid, putting in an afternoon concert, creating a brand around that. Yeah. It seemed a more modern schedule.
Yes, exactly. And I also think it's an interesting, you know, Radio 3 is a brand, the BBC is a brand, but they have to kind of design the slots that people can regularly kind of tune into. And it's something that perhaps younger audiences are a bit more used to. You know, you choose your time slot and you know what you're going to get.
I think that's very good scheduling everywhere.
I mean, Radio Station and telly as well, it's more tap-like, isn't it? You want to know what you get when
we
turn
started channels way back in the 1990s, the new channels, this was the USP that we had, that we could stream it, the show across the week. I'd like to know if they're still keeping Coral Evensong. That's on a Wednesday, by the way. Another plug for that.
But we'll ask Sam to see if that has survived.
Get on to him personally for me.
The BBC also announced a number of new BBC Sounds commissions, and Liz, you mentioned this. There's a certain amount of leaning into celebrity. So there's shows with Natalie Cassidy and Joanna Page about television, Lily Allen and Makita Oliver doing a double act as well. Popularity, celebrities are a great shortcut to getting interest. They don't always turn into great shows. Some do. Are they right to lean into celebrity, Liz?
What I think is so funny is that a lot of these people mean nothing to me. And this is what I think is changing about celebrity. The day of that big household name is coming to an end. There will always be some big household names. But the idea that celebrity means household name, that's no longer the equation anymore. So, in a sense, if they're good at the job and they bring an audience, what's the problem?
Jane, Liz is right. Sort of, it's hard to find big superstar celebrities.
Yeah. And you didn't mention Ryland, by the
way. Yes, Ryland's coming
he's
back.
Pretty, he's
coming back. I do like Ryland.
He has broad appeal, and he's he's one of the kind of the bigger ones, I think. I think it's all a question of balance for me. So they may have chosen to publicise these names because obviously it means something to some people, if not all. But equally, you know, there is a role for the BBC, which they know and they do acknowledge, to produce and bring up, talent that people haven't heard of, that's untapped. You know, one would hope that they were doing that alongside the big names as well, the bigger names.
I mean, they have just launched... they have a big new audio creators fund, which features new people to audio, new diverse voices. So you've got that at the same time. Does it get perhaps the same push?
I think it used to be worse because, because of the big celebrity cult. Mm. I, years ago, auditioned for a presenter role on Radio 4. It was just a bit of a, have a go. And I know that I did a really good audition. I know that. You know how sometimes you don't, sometimes you do.
But you nailed it.
I nailed it. Right. Okay. I might not have been right for the job, but I nailed it. And the people who were doing the auditions couldn't have been less interested. They didn't even show me where the toilet was. I got lost on the way to the lift. I felt totally unloved. And I found out afterwards that a very well-known celebrity was going to get the gig. And I felt so cross. And I wish now I'd called them out on it because it really was unfair. Mm. So it's forever thus. And I don't think this is as bad as that. But then I wouldn't, would I?
Well, we're going to find out more about your Radio 4 career during the break. And after that, we'll be back with more media news.
Non-career.
C'est So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday's the anniversary of Jarvis Cocker's stage invasion of Michael Jackson's performance at the Brits.
Then on Tuesday, we tell the story of the Spaniard who named Florida.
On Wednesday, it's the birth of instant photography, the Polaroid camera.
Thursday was the day Dolly became the world's most famous sheep.
And on Friday, the foiled 19th century plot to kill the entire British cabinet.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. Jane and Liz are here for some more news in brief. Vice Media is to close its website this week, marking another decline of the generation-defining brand, both for audiences and journalists. Jane, several hundred jobs are to go, but the company isn't shutting down entirely. What's their new thing?
Well, I think the idea is that they're going to keep going on some forms of content, but they're going to shut down mainly the news items and split off Refinery 29, which is more of a kind of content creation agency. So presumably divest themselves of that as well.
Are they basically becoming a sort of branded content operation?
I would have thought that's more like what they're going to do. And, you know, when they first launched, they were fairly radical as a kind of digital content production unit. They did provocative content. They did what looked like sort of fairly costly sort of interviews, programs, that kind of thing. Again, for me, you know, it comes down to ad revenue, doesn't it? They would keep going if they were getting the revenues for it. So I think it's just a sensible trimming and realizing that actually, you know, advertisers are being more creative now. They want new ways to reach audiences and, you know, new formats for content production, which are commercially funded, are probably the way forward. You know, a standalone, you know, news content production agency is a challenge now. And there's a question about new brands and, you know, old brands, you know, the brands we know, you know, tend to be winning in this space. There's lots of these newer organisations that seem to be shutting down, like BuzzFeed, for example.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, was Vice always a bit of a con?
I think that Vice majored on an image and it marketed itself to millennials with that image.
Yep.
And millennials get old, you know, she said with some glee. And so the audience changes, and what can you do when the audience changes? I think it's just old fashioned now. It's had its day. The group that really loved it don't love it as much. Advertisers want something different. I think this relationship with advertising is fascinating because I think advertisers are absolutely the bellwether of our society. They tell us more about our society than any amount of surveys, what advertisers are doing. Mm. And they're moving away from this sort of thing.
I mean, Liz is right. Advertisers are looking at data all the time, aren't they?
Yeah,
and sometimes they have an opinion. They do things based on opinion rather than the data. But they've probably got the most data.
Yes, that is absolutely right. You know, and obviously we work with them a lot, you know, looking at different kinds of research, whether it's brand image research or advertising effectiveness and that kind of thing. You know, ultimately, you know, they do have a degree of control over what happens to large and small media outlets because they're funding them. Unless they have, you know, unless these media platforms have subscription channels or, you know, other forms of revenue, advertising does tend to lead the way. Well, advertising also does, you know, slightly blow with the wind. You know, a new format comes up, advertisers will start pushing money into that. you know, media agencies obviously have a role to play. They're doing the planning and the buying on those campaigns. But, you know, I think Liz is right. It's a question of the brand vice didn't move on with the audience, and advertisers aren't keen on that. They want to be where the action is.
And the advertising issue is fascinating, isn't it? Because there's the ethical element as well, because advertising is basically often persuading people to do something they hadn't thought of doing. That might be a good thing. It might easily be a bad thing. And I have friends who get terribly irate about the idea of, say, impoverished families being forced by extra Christmas presents and so on. These friends of mine work in social work and that sort of thing. And you know, advertising is not necessarily good, but it's not necessarily bad either, because it can bring you to things that you didn't know existed. But it's something that does need, in my view, constant regulation as well. So the advertisers do tell us so much that we don't know, but they can also lead us very badly astray. So it is this mixed economy thing. We need the advertising, but we also need control on the advertising. Well,
also, I was thinking about Vice, and the people that they managed to persuade were investors. They extracted a lot of money, particularly out of old media.
And that's why you were saying about it being a con. I do think there was a terrific feeling at the time that we were all going to hell in a handcart. We were the canals and the railway were coming along. Yeah. Oh, what are we going to do? You know. And there is always this fear. And things always settle, you know. Yeah. Movies are not killed by radio, and television hasn't killed radio and so on. It's always a layered thing.
Do you think it will survive on as a in that branded world, or really is it done now?
Don't know. Yeah. Don't know. There are lots of other companies doing that kind of thing, obviously, and there are lots of companies who do it very specifically for formats for various different channels. You know, the big thing marketers are looking at now is influencers, which are growing in their appeal year on year. Slightly to my surprise, to be honest, but they morph as well into different forms of content. So who knows? I think it's, you know, I don't know how long they have in cash flow terms, but they have to, I think, make a big impact fairly quickly. Otherwise, it's not going
to
go well.
And it's hard to know what that impact would be, isn't it? What the USP is.
Now it's kind of over to Layoff Corner, which I feel like every week I'm talking about more cuts.
Yeah.
So latest on the list, Sony PlayStation are to close their London studio as part of some wider cuts. So the studio over here in the UK was working quite a lot on VR gaming. I know Jane Cantor look at all of these sort of different topics.
Yeah.
Does this say something about faith in VR has dropped a little?
It probably does. I mean, VR's been sort of bubbling for, well over 10, 15 years now as the next big thing that's going to happen next year. And every single year it doesn't quite happen. And, you know, we look at sort of movies with sort of totally immersive gaming environments. And, you know, the promise was always there. I do think that there's some hope coming back to the Gen AI conversation with Gen AI, because actually, you know, gaming development is hugely costly, takes a lot of people, as we can see. And it might be that Gen AI can actually produce some of those concepts and environments, you know, in a more efficient way. But it does speak to the idea, I think, that VR is always the next big thing, and you know, still with, you know, headsets and whatnot, which never really, it's just not convincing.
But we've got close now, haven't we? Maybe you always say this with every headset release. Yeah. Obviously, the Apple headsets. It's very expensive, but pretty good immersive environment.
Yes.
But it's more about AR, augmenting reality, than being sort of full VR.
Pokemon Plus.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 How many people really want to be in virtual reality? I mean, reality is bad enough for many. I just don't think it's a concept that really, really works for human beings. That's perhaps being a bit extreme. I mean, you might do a bit of it or so on, but to live your life doing that. I mean, people watch, say, even now, 3 or 4 hours of television a week, don't they? And would they really stick their head in a headset for 3 or 4 hours a week? Well, I suppose some people would. But it seems to me that Jane's absolutely right. It's not something that's really going to take off. It hasn't done.
I mean, on the gaming side, and actually just on the sort of individual VR side, it's a very individualistic experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of a lot of media, and you watch the telly or you watch films together in a lounge.
And games, multiplayer games as well, which is, you know, that's part of the fun. My sons were constantly sort of playing games that were, you know, involved shouting in their bedrooms with lots of other randoms around the world. You know,
I know a couple that met between Britain and Australia through being involved in a gaming environment where they were avatars, and that's not going to happen if you're talking to yourself in your headset. Yeah.
But maybe you meet in the metaverse. Now, obviously, metaverse mentions somewhat declined over the last 12 months as well.
Yes, and metaverse. You know, I keep coming back to this research, media reactions research. Metaverse was hugely popular with marketers last year's study. They said they were all going to spend 42% more on the metaverse. And that's kind of, they've gone very quiet on that now. Marketers haven't really spoken about that for a while. So.
Maybe they're in the metaverse and we just haven't noticed what they're saying.
It's a possibility.
I thought the metaverse was a poetry anthology.
That'd be a very special VR environment. Right, our last story before the quiz. There was a summit this week on the future of kids TV hosted by the Children's Media Foundation. One of the key messages was that the government may need to intervene to prevent British culture being overwhelmed by international productions of varying quality. I mean, this isn't a new story. This is something that children's TV has faced significantly, sort of accelerated by the government doing quite a well-meaning thing of removing food and drink advertising from kids' TV 10 years ago. But it is meaning producers struggle to make a living or decide to make any kids' content.
Well, it's not the government's responsibility to enable people to make a living when there isn't a market for it. However, I do think that there's a market for British localised children's television. I do think it is probably the job of the public service broadcasters to do this. And I do agree we might end up with them having more obligations than they've got privileges. And when that balance is destroyed, then public service broadcasting goes. But at this stage, I think we could have some sort of protected environment for children's programming. Not hugely, but just enough to make sure that we've got our own localised product. Can I say that I'm a huge fan of CBeebies?
Yes.
I think it's absolutely wonderful. I couldn't get through the day with my grandson without it.
I'm glad you had your grandson in there.
Yes. No, there's a limit to virtual reality, believe me. No, it's very, very important, I think, in our landscape to have CBeebies. And I can see why children's BBC did not have the same reach, because the children are at school, they come back, they've got other influences going on in their lives. But I do think a small, selected, protected area might be acceptable.
I mean, Jane, Peppa Pig's held up as a prime cultural export, prime cut cultural export. Is that just a bit of an outlier, though? You can't build an industry on
successes. It comes back to the conversation about brands, doesn't it? What the brand is it the channel, is it the program, is it the strand? And I think we've got a really interesting scenario now where actually nearly 20 years ago, actually, when I worked on the digital switchover to TV and marketing, and children's ITV, CBeebies, CBBC were the channels that we led with their logos to explain, this is why you need to switch over. You get more channels, you get, you know, there's something for everybody. And children was one of the key kind of drivers for that. But, you know, the reality is that kids are spending a lot of time not watching television now. They're online instead. They're on YouTube. Whether it's suitable for them or not is a completely different conversation. But, you know, we do have to move with the times.
Well, I was going to say, is that the other question? Like, when we talk, because there was a very good children's content fund that ran for 3 years that wasn't renewed by the government. And there's similarly in radio as well, which was a shame, because both were deemed to be very successful. But it does need the government to put their hands in their pockets. But that was about television. Does this need to be about public service content, no matter where it is?
I think so, yes. It is about the content. It doesn't matter what the platform is. And I do think you mustn't get confused between preschool and children's. Peppa Pig is preschool, and preschool is still very strong, and we do very well with preschool in this country. Children's television, if you like, is different. It's sort of the 5+, 6+. It's more like dramas. And, of course, there's Newsround, which I think is very popular still, and shown in schools and so on. So be careful about that distinction. I don't think we have too much to worry about with preschool. It's children's programmes where we have the difficulty. And, yes, I think it would be a good idea if it was supported. But then everyone wants support. That's the problem.
Everyone wants some cash, definitely. Right, just enough time for the media quiz. This week entitled Begin Again. A few brands and celebrities are rebooting this week in the news. Can you tell me who they are from these cryptic questions? So buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Jane, you will say...
Jane.
And Liz, you will say.
Liz. I thought he was going to say, buzz in with your names if you know them.
Exactly. If that's the level, the quiz is going to be quite tough. Okay, here we go. Let's play Begin Again. Question number one. After just 3 years, who's suddenly leaving Virgin Radio weekends?
Oh, Graham Norton, Liz.
Liz.
Cheat. I'm not leaving. I'm not on it.
So Graham, he's off. Is he just off for a rest or is he off somewhere else?
I can't work that out. There seems to be some suggestion he's going elsewhere.
Perhaps, yeah, the rumours are that he could be going to Radio 2, filling in for the Steve Wright slot, but who knows?
I think... He's just off for a rest. He got married last year, I think. So his life has changed. He mentioned this briefly on the show, and he sort of said he will still pop up on Virgin. So I just think he's gone, I've done this for 13 years on Radio 2 and on Virgin Radio. I'm 60, 61. I've got a lovely new husband. I'm just going to have my weekends back. So I think...
Good luck.
I look forward to this being found to be completely untrue when he signs a big money deal next week. Okay. Question number two. Who is Emma Barnett rumoured to be replacing?
Martha Kearney on Radio 4's Today programme.
Yes. So Martha Kearney, she's going to be stepping down after the next general election.
Yep.
And Emma does Woman's Hour at the moment.
Yeah, she's been doing it for, I think, 2 or 3 years now. I remember her when she was the digital media correspondent at the Daily Telegraph, and she was always interviewing us when we worked in digital radio, funnily enough. And I think she's brilliant. She's kind of ferocious and brilliant at the same time. Very good interviewer, very incisive. So I think she'd be great on the Today programme.
I agree. I think she'd be good on Today. It'd be interesting to see that.
And how do you think Martha's done?
Very well. She's very good. Lovely voice, very sensible. Questions. Yeah, there's so many good women on TV and radio. Can I use this as a plug?
Yes.
For my expert women research.
Yes.
We've come back after 10 years to measure the number of women on standard flagship television news. And when we started doing this, the statistic was 5 times as many men were interviewed. This is not about the professionals.
Yeah.
This is about the members of the public who were interviewed. 5 times as many men in authority were interviewed as women. Then it got a lot better and it sort of evened out. And in fact, once it was actually 1.5 times as many men. That was like for 1 month, February in 2018, I think. I fear since the pandemic it has got a lot worse. We've now done 10 years of this campaign and we're having a big, significant conference in June looking at the figures. And I will tell you then, I hope, what it looks like. But I'm not entirely optimistic.
Well, it's good. I think that sort of research, and I know from talking to people who work in news, has made them think about it more. And some of this isn't that it's men picking men. It's just you aren't, that whoever the producer is, just isn't thinking about it enough when they see their programme.
They don't think about who the female options are. And they go to the people they've always gone to.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And often they're working with big ticket presenters who only want to talk to people who think are really important. And that happens to be men like them. Mm. So it's a difficult one.
Right. Question number three. Which format has just celebrated its 50th remake?
You might have to tell us.
This is a business show.
Business show, 50th remake.
Business show with some business experts on a panel as people come and suggest...
Dragon's Den.
Yes, it is Dragon's Den. Okay. So Dragon's Den celebrates 50th remake after announcing a version in Bangladesh. Liz, it's quite a feat getting to 50 territories with anything, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. I think the Dragon's Den title is such a good one, actually. It could almost be Game of Thrones, couldn't it? All that stuff. It's a very good title. It's a very good format. It works everywhere. You know, business is the one universal thing across the whole world.
Yes.
There's business going on, isn't there?
And obviously it's in the US, the Shark Tank in the US too. And it's had a bit of a resurgence here.
Yes, it has. And it is, I have to say, addictive viewing. And it's mainly because, obviously, you've got the dragons themselves who are, you know, either being nice or horrible or rude or supportive, whatever they choose to be. But it's also because you're on both sides as a viewer. And in the business world, we're constantly being encouraged to think, what's the short version of what you want to say? You know, I'm not presenting a 97-page PowerPoint deck anymore. I have to think of what's the bullet point summary of a piece of research. So you're constantly thinking, God, that elevator pitch is rubbish. Why don't they know what their profit was in year two? And, you know, and so you get sort of emotionally invested in both sides of the... So it is a really clever format.
It is a great format, yeah.
I'd love to know what the net profits or slash net loss of the of all of that will be over those 50 territories. That'd be fascinating.
Now, that would be interesting. They could compete, couldn't they?
It's an international kind of compete-off at the end.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Come up with a new format. Well, Jane, you've just slightly won the competition, I think. And as your prize, you can go and explore our new evolution of the Dragon's Den format around the world.
See if you will do that straight away, Matt.
Sell that in.
Well, we're all investing right now.
Yes, I'm 100% in. Okay, my thanks to Liz Howell and Jane Osler. Jane, where can people find out about what you and Kantar are up to?
Kantar.com is our website, and you can look for the Future Proof podcast on all major platforms.
Wherever you're listening to this one.
Yeah.
And Liz, what have you been up to?
Well, I write books as well, so I've got a detective story out called The Gardener in the Graveyard, which is doing quite well, thank you very much. That's on Amazon. But also The Expert Women Project. Mm. That's, I hope, going to be making some headlines in June, and look out for it on our website, expertwomenproject.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today. Remember to be just like Jane and use the studios here at the London Podcast Studios, where we give you 25% off your first studio booking if you use the code MEDIAPOD. Just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off with the code MEDIAPOD. And if you're new to the show, make sure you follow it so you get every new episode in your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can also look at us at YouTube and see my lovely smiling face. I'm Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production, and we'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.